I'd like to ask a couple of questions about what we said yesterday, and then we can go ahead probably rather quickly.
All right.
About the graduate degree programs within anatomy, did anatomy offer both masters of science and PhDs?
Yes.
And they did this throughout your career? Were both of those degrees offered from 1925?
Yes.
How is the curriculum for any particular PhD program determined? Was there a set?
It was determined partly by the interest of the individual and also by the man he was working with,
mm-hmm.
but controlled as far as prerequisites or
yes.
things were concerned by the biological division, graduate biological division.
And that's what you were
They
discussing.
Set certain standards for
mm-hmm. How are the students admitted? For instance, were your students admitted by you individually?
Yes.
So that the chairman wouldn't control that aspect of
no.
the program?
No, I don't think so. I suppose it had been, if I'd admitted some without good judgment, I suppose there might have been some
mm-hmm.
kickback that way. And of course the department, if a person wasn't doing well, the department would probably insist that they be dropped.
Mm-hmm.
I dropped one man only,
mm-hmm.
my memory. I had a fellow with a stuffed shirt, and he didn't measure up, and I just told him I didn't want him.
Mm-hmm.
You had the right to do that.
Yes.
And he could have gone to somebody else in the department, probably.
I see.
But I didn't have to teach him.
So when an application would come in for graduate study, would you actually receive it? Do you recall the process?
Well, I think the application for graduate study went to the graduate school
mm-hmm.
first.
Yes.
And then the person indicated what department they wanted to major in.
Yes.
And went to somebody down there in that department, usually somebody that they had known about.
Mm-hmm.
I had people come over from zoology that were dissatisfied with something in zoology, thought wasn't just the line of work they wanted to do, so they came over and talked to me, and sometimes I accept them, sometimes I didn't, because I felt that I know one girl I didn't accept because she wanted to do really zoological work, and I told her she should stay in that department.
I see.
Even though I was a zoologist, I mm-hmm. felt that her work with animal behavior, and I didn't want to get tangled up with that.
Mm-hmm. About Chairman Sullivan.
Yes.
Did he control the promotions within the department as chairman?
Yes, he did, I think, very distinctly.
Was there a process such as there is now where the candidate for promotion can ask to be considered for promotion at a certain time? How did the process work?
Well, I don't think there was any recourse except to Sullivan or the dean. I told you, I didn't.
Yes.
Once I went to the dean. But there were no department meetings. I don't know whether he consulted with the dean at all or not. I doubt it.
Mm-hmm.
I think he just did as he pleased.
Do you have an interpretation or an analysis of why it was that you were forced to go to the dean? Do you know why you were passed by?
I don't have any idea other than just personal things. I mean, Sullivan had wanted me to work with him on X-ray work. I didn't want to do it. I wasn't interested in it. I told him I didn't want to.
Yes.
And Mortensen came as a student who didn't have much money and was a hard-working fellow and a very fine person. And he, I don't know whether this had anything to do with it or not, but he was engaged to a girl in Milwaukee. To a nurse, and all of a sudden he got a letter that she was married. And I guess it is when he was a student, when he was a, I think it's when he was, before he was in the department. He might have been a instructor, a student instructor at the time, I'm not sure. But anyway, I think it broke him up pretty bad at the time. And Sullivan took him out to his house, and I guess he stayed out there at Sullivan's house for a while. And he did everything he could to make March see the light. And he later married a very fine woman who's still living. She's here this summer to see me. Well, anyway, there's things like that. I think Sullivan sort of considered not... Well, later on, I know I was told by one of the Mortensen family that he'd been promised things when he came back to the department. Obviously, Sullivan had liked him and promised him that he would be promoted and that he would be made head of the department, which he had no right to do, really. I mean, that should have been a departmental meeting thing, but it wasn't. There were no such thing. Mm-hmm. That's part of the, that's one of the things that brought the trouble with the medical school, where people are department chairman are sort of handing down their chairmanship to one of their favorites.
Mm-hmm. And that referred to both types of departments, the clinical department as well as the basic science department.
The whole medical school was more or less a family affair, which was nice in a way, but it led to problems. Mm-hmm. It led to people being promoted who weren't quite fitting into the university idea of what should be the criteria for promotion. Research is at least half of it.
Yes.
And Mortensen wasn't doing that. And,
I see.
To any great extent, he did some good research, but relatively little.
Was there discussion in the department among the other faculty members about this kind of situation?
Not that I know of. No. I just went on my own to the dean.
Do you know how it happened that he became chairman?
Well, I think, again, that was because Bardeen liked him and thought he was a good teacher and a good man to be chairman. Uh-huh. It's purely a personal thing. I don't think the graduate school or the medical faculty had anything to do with it, or the former people in the anatomy department, other than the Bardeen.
Yes, I see. And Sullivan had been acting as chairman. Unofficially. While Bardeen.
Unofficially, and Bardeen had been chairman first. See, Bardeen was the first chairman of anatomy.
Yeah.
Actually, William Snow Miller, the zoologist, had been teaching some histology and was here before Bardeen came.
Mm-hmm. Was Miller here when you were?
Yes. Yes, he was in the department, but he wasn't teaching. He was already retired, I think, when I first came into work.
So what kind of activities was he working on?
He was doing research on lung, of which he did a lot of very good research of that type that was done in those days. Mm-hmm. Beautiful injections. He was interested in the circulation, and he developed some very fine injection techniques for injecting vessels, showing them later.
How was he perceived by his colleagues in the department, would you say?
Well, he was well regarded, very well regarded, except that he was a cantankerous old devil and had gallbladder trouble, and after he had that out, he was much more approachable.
Do you know why it was that Bardeen decided to leave the chairmanship? Was there any discussion
of
that?
I don't know of any, other than just that he had other things he wanted to do.
Yes. During the World War II, Sullivan remained chairman, is that correct?
Yes.
And remained on campus, I guess.
Oh, yes. Geist was the only one that went away to war.
And he was gone, did he return then?
Yes, he returned after, a year or so after the war was over.
Mm-hmm. How did the war affect the work in the department, or did it?
Well, it affected in this way that very definitely, in that we taught year-round. We had no, just as soon as one semester ended, another one began within about a week.
Mm-hmm.
And
why was that?
Well, to try to produce more doctors. That was true all through the medical schools in this country, apparently.
I see.
They went on a continuous schedule. And we had no summer vacation. We just went right into teaching.
Were there special programs? Were there special students brought in out in addition to the medical school students?
In addition to the medical school at that time?
Yeah. For instance, people preparing to be medics or something like that.
I suppose there were more pre-medics coming in, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how that, I don't know about that.
Then Sullivan remained chair until about 1946. Is that,
I don't have the exact.
I have conflicting.
He was succeeded by Mortensen.
Yes.
I'm not sure just when that
I have conflicting data on that. One place said 1946, another said 1950.
Well, I would sooner think 1950,
mm-hmm.
because we moved into the new building in 57.
Mm-hmm.
And I think so. I think 1950 or later.
Mm-hmm.
Not. You'd have to look it up in the official.
Sure. The in the post-World War II period, were there significant changes in the department and its program?
Well, yes. As soon as Mortensen became chairman anyway, we began to hire new people. And one was Slaughterbach. First one was Anderson, mm-hmm. John Anderson. And then he located Slaughterbach. It was after we moved into the new building then.
Which was?
57. We moved into the new Bardeen medical labs.
Yes.
And before that, Anderson was the first new one before that.
Mm-hmm.
And then at that time, just about that time, I think it was Slaughterbach came. Slaughterbach was never over in the Science Hall. He came directly into the new mm-hmm. Bardeen.
So the faculty was growing in numbers?
Faculty started to grow rapidly right then.
How do you account for that?
Money. Well, two things. There was a movement to increase the number in all medical schools, the number of people being trained.
Mm-hmm.
And that applied to us because we'd been taking a freshman class of at most 125,
mm-hmm.
usually around 90. And they decided to, when they built the Bardeen, they were building it for a bigger class, somewhat bigger. And there wasn't a push right away for the considerable increase that came later, but there was some increase, to be some increase. And then I think the other thing was money. People began to have enough money for research, and the department had enough money so that they could teach just one course, one semester,
mm-hmm.
and be free for research and the second semester.
Mm-hmm.
We taught, in those earlier days, we taught both semesters and sometimes two courses at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And that general reduction of teaching coursework made it possible made it necessary to have more professorial rank. And also gave them a chance to have grad students and mm-hmm. and do a lot more research.
So you might have gone from a teaching load of, say, four courses in an academic year during the 1930s to one course in an academic year in 1955.
That's right. That's right. Even one semester. Mm-hmm. Most of us continued to, I think several of us continued to teach both semesters, but mm-hmm. but there were those that didn't, that mm-hmm. had just one course.
Can you characterize Mortensen's style as the department head?
Well,
say compared to Sullivan.
Very similar, except that we did then have faculty meetings. He was more democratic in that sense. Mm-hmm. We had much more, and we had faculty meetings and determined things, took votes on who'd be chairman even. Mm-hmm. After that, and people liked Morrison, and he was a good chairman, and so I would say that he had all the good qualities that Sullivan had, and from my standpoint, some additional ones.
Mm-hmm. Were there important events or conflicts during the years that he was chair that stand out?
No, I don't think we see. I don't know of any conflicts, except of some splitting of the feeling about Bowers in the department. He and Mortensen Bowers didn't get along, and some of the others did.
On what basis would that?
Well, the general idea of Bowers that he should be appointing people who did research and
yes.
in the clinical years and things like that, and then Mortensen just naturally didn't like a man of Bowers' type. Mm-hmm. I mean, Bowers was
because of his personality.
His personality. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just annoyed people like Mortensen, who were kindly, personable people. Mm-hmm. And he didn't like that roughshod approach to friends of his. I don't think Bowers ever tried to do any dirt to Mortensen. Mm-hmm. Specifically, I doubt it. Mm-hmm. But
did Mortensen have control over the salaries as Sullivan had? Were those open?
I think not as much. I think that he promoted, he recommended for promotion, I'm sure of that. Mm-hmm. But I think the executive committee had to vote on all these things, as I told you yesterday about the two members of the executive committee who refused to vote
yes.
anyone in.
So that was the executive committee for the medical school?
For the executive committee for the medical school,
yes.
which consisted of the heads of departments,
yes.
or chairman, or whatever you call them. Mm-hmm.
With regard to research at the medical school, in the department in the post-war years, How did the status of anatomy stand during those years? Did it improve, diminish?
You mean at our department? Or?
Yes, anatomy.
Oh, it increased, I think, as far as research is concerned, there's mm-hmm. a tremendous amount of more modern, sophisticated type research has been done since the war than before, and, mm-hmm. and a great increase in the type of neural anatomy work. Its department became rather famous for the neural anatomy.
Mm-hmm. Would you,
we had a foreigner here, Ockert, who was from Switzerland, who was well known before he came, mm-hmm. and we had other people who continued in anatomy, in this work, mm-hmm. and still do. Head of the department now is a well-known neuroanatomist.
Did that become sort of the most prominent aspect of the department then?
I think so, yes. Well, quite a lot of it nationally too. It was there was a great upsurge in research in the field of neural anatomy. There was also cell biology and a lot of work done with electron microscopes, Schlatterbach and was specifically a cell biologist, really. He's done a lot of work, but then he became chairman and couldn't devote himself to chairmanship. His work slipped.
If we were now to look at the medical school as a whole, and look at the Bardeen years up to 1935, what would you say his image or view or ideal of the university medical school would have been? How would he have defined the medical school he wanted to see at the university?
How would he have defined it?
Yeah.
Bardeen?
Yeah.
Oh, I can't answer that. I don't know, I suppose. I think he was more interested in medical skill than he was in research in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Although he was a research man himself originally. Did a lot of very good embryological research.
It's said, for instance, E.B. Fred said in an interview that I've seen, that there were many people in the medical school from Johns Hopkins Medical School.
Yeah.
And it seems to come up over and over again. Was there any kind of a direct example that was followed from Johns Hopkins? Was there some kind of influence?
Well, Johns Hopkins, I think, was the model for a good many years for schools, the better schools in this country, mm-hmm. not just Wisconsin. Of course, Johns Hopkins has sort of fallen behind now in that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. What was it about it that distinguished it?
Well, the research attitude, I think, Hopkins was always, in the early years, was always a strong research element there.
Mm-hmm.
And they had prominent people who spoke well and presented the whole thing well,
mm-hmm.
scientifically.
Mm-hmm. Were there other universities that served as examples for the Madison program?
Well, I don't know. Of course, Middleton himself was from Pennsylvania.
Yes.
And there were some from the university, from the South. I should say that's more of an influence. Well, there's several in the medical schools in the South,
mm-hmm.
but up to Virginia and so on. And that was true of the university as a whole, especially the Ag School.
Mm-hmm.
Fred and mm-hmm. different ones and a great many graduate students, even in my day. Mm-hmm. Were Southerners that came up here, and many of them stayed. Several of them stayed on,
yes.
in the ag school. Mm-hmm. That wasn't as prominent in the medical school, but there was certainly some indication of that.
How would you characterize Bardeen's style as dean?
Using his own personal judgment on just about everything, regardless of what the faculty or the departments thought.
Were there committees? Were there executive committee meetings?
I don't think so. I think I don't believe so. I don't know enough really about it because I wasn't in the administrative position, but I don't think so. I know we would, as a first year committee, the faculty the first year would get together to talk over the students at the end of the semester.
Mm-hmm.
And we would have some poor ones and we'd vote to drop them or to ask them to repeat the year next year.
Mm-hmm.
And quite often the next day they'd be back in with a permit from the dean to re-enter.
I see.
Things like that, mm-hmm. which are a little frustrating.
Yes. So the entire medical school faculty would meet to discuss the first-year students?
No, the first-year faculty. The people teaching the first-year courses, on, there's a first-year committee, a second-year committee, third-year committee, and a fourth-year committee in the medical school in those days. Mm-hmm. It would not, and there may still be, but discuss the promotions at the end of the year. There are always a few people who are questionable.
Mm-hmm.
And we would have a first-year committee consensus on these, vote unanimously to have someone either repeat the year or drop them, and quite frequently they'd be right back in with the dean's permission.
How did the faculty, how did Bardeen express any opinion about having faculty members that were women or that were Jewish?
I never knew it.
So there was no tendency in the...
Well, I suppose he was like most, I think most people at that time felt that if they could get a man instead of a woman, they would.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I never heard him express anything about it one way or the other. It was rarely discussed, actually,
mm-hmm.
as far as I know, in those days.
Do you recall the progressive salary waivers in the early 30s?
Recall what?
The progressive salary waivers, where the faculty took pay cuts, the higher paid faculty members took a greater percentage cut.
I'm not sure how that was. I know we had these waivers.
Yes.
During the Depression period, but I don't know whether it was. It amounted to more. I think it was probably a straight percentage cut. I'm not sure of that.
Mm-hmm.
But the smaller salary you got, the worse it was, of course.
Sure. Was there much discussion among you and your colleagues about the pay cut?
No, I think I didn't discuss it much. I just took it for as a something I had to deal with.
Sure.
In fact, I think most of us were glad we had a job.
Yeah. With regard to the curriculum in the medical school, you hear of the preceptorship program.
Yes.
Did that have anything to do with you? Did you know much about that?
No, I don't, except that on general principles, I'd say it's an excellent idea.
Mm-hmm.
It gets the student out into contact with actual medical practice as it's done in the sort of position he would likely be in.
Mm-hmm.
As out in a small town or city practice alone or possibly with one or two others.
Mm-hmm.
And quite different than hospital practice.
Middleton mentions what he calls the integrated curriculum. Do you know, can you explain that to me?
Integrated curriculum?
Yes.
I don't think we ever had a really integrated curriculum. To my knowledge, might be in something he was talking about in the clinical years, but
that could be.
But certainly not in the preclinical years.
Mm-hmm. Outside practice for physicians who are also faculty members, was that an issue?
That was an issue not with us, but with the clinical people and the physicians in town here who were not in the university, because mm-hmm. that was there's been a battle about that for years, ever since the medical school started.
Mm-hmm. Did the basic science faculty members have a feeling about it either way? Were they interested in the debate?
Well, I don't think someone might have had individual feeling about it. I always felt that if a faculty man was furnished his office and everything, he really shouldn't try to compete anyway. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I felt that in order to keep good men here, we had to let them do it.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have, you couldn't make up, the state couldn't afford to pay the salary that would be necessary to equal the salary of some of the better private practitioners,
mm-hmm.
equal the income of some of the better private practitioners.
Here we go. Did medical school faculty members, anatomy and outside of anatomy and other departments, have experience studying in Europe? Would that have been an important factor in their
experience in Europe?
Yes.
Oh yes, some of them did. It was depended. I think that experience was mainly had an impact on their research work, not on teachings,
mm-hmm.
to any great extent.
Was there widespread support from Wharf for medical school faculty members? You mentioned that you had received support.
I think so. Preclinical science,
mm-hmm.
anyway. I don't know about the clinical people.
Mm-hmm.
I doubt if there's much support to clinical people, but certainly preclinical.
Do you know how it happened that Middleton became dean in 1935?
That Middleton was made dean?
Yes.
No, I don't.
Had he worked?
He'd been here.
Mm-hmm.
When I first came here in 20, there was a little clinic building down on Langdon Street, where the union is now.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody got sick, student got sick, it was a student health clinic. We'd go down there, and Middleton was a young fellow there at that time. I think he came here probably about the same time I did,
mm-hmm.
about 1920,
mm-hmm.
possibly before, a little before.
Had he been working with Bardeen, to your knowledge?
Not that I know of.
Who do you suppose decided that he would be? Who would have decided that he became dean?
Well, I don't know how that was. I have no idea how that was done, but it probably would involve, of course, the president of the university. But Middleton was probably the outstanding clinician of the school,
mm-hmm.
when he became dean. And I think probably just his reputation as an excellent clinician and the fact that he'd been around other schools. That was always one reason that I was glad that Mortensen never was made dean, because Mortensen never was out away from here very much. He was pretty totally inbred here, except for one semester at Hopkins,
mm-hmm.
at the Carnegie. Well, he wasn't, yes, I guess he was the Carnegie, Hopkins anyway. But Mortensen would have had to learn, after he became dean, about a lot of things that are going on outside.
Mm-hmm.
I think he eventually knew, had experience enough so that he knew, but he had not been away,
mm-hmm.
and really wasn't really conversant with what.
Middleton, you'll recall in his oral history transcript, says that the basic function of the medical school is to train doctors.
Yes.
And after that, if there's resources and time, then you do research.
Yeah.
Is that an accurate representation of the kind of ideal he portrayed as dean?
Well, I think so. I never heard him express that in words, but
mm-hmm.
I think it's still more or less true. You've got to support the clinicians on the hospital. You've got to support the student, the patient care.
Mm-hmm.
That comes first. You can't let that go.
Mm-hmm. I've had the impression, perhaps from the interview I've read of Philip Cohen, that there might have been more support for basic science research in the medical school.
Well, he felt, I'm sure he felt so, and from what I read out too, mm-hmm. and I think that's true.
Was that an issue in the 1930s? Was that something that researchers discussed?
I think it was to some extent. I don't remember specifically very much discussion of it, actually, but I'm pretty sure that Middleton valued the clinical work more than he did the research work.
Mm-hmm.
He felt the research work should come from, well, there would be clinical research, I'm sure, that he was interested in,
mm-hmm.
but he felt the basic sciences would go along and be doing the research. I don't, and of course it's true, I think, that I'm always a little suspicious of research in my field, for instance, that's done by clinicians. When I find that something published in the American Journal of Gynecology or the American Medical Journal or something, I look at it with a very critical eye, because so until relatively recent years, an awful lot of lousy and irresponsible type of research was done, published in medical journals on things that they didn't really have any basic knowledge of and didn't understand in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Well, would Middleton's approach to supporting the different aspects of the medical school work, the clinical people, the basic science people, would that have been during the 1930s, would that have been considered a wise approach in light of other medical schools in the country?
Well, I would say probably the majority of them, yes. Now, it might have not been considered a wise approach by Hopkins and Harvard and a few of those, but where there was a lot of research going on,
mm-hmm.
and good research, but a clinical man, a medical student, the average medical student that goes into a hospital and during his residency tries to put out a piece of research is not trained for research as a rule.
Yes.
Medical courses are not research courses. They're like any other undergraduate, almost like any other undergraduate course.
Mm-hmm.
And unless he's had, that's why I was always glad to take medical students for a summer of research or something like that, because they got a little training at least in how you go about it and how you look at it,
mm-hmm.
what the critical eye you have to have on to do good research.
Did you personally feel that you were receiving the kind of support from the dean that you needed to do your own research work?
In general, yes, I did. I didn't think the only thing that I didn't like was the slow advancement.
Mm-hmm. Dean Middleton remained in office through 1955. In the years after World War II, did your opinion of his support remain the same?
Oh, yes. I always liked Middleton. I always felt he was a fair
mm-hmm.
person.
Do you recall if he?
I felt he was idolized a little more than he deserved.
Mm-hmm.
But
why would that be?
Well, I don't know. There was a group in the clinical people and the medics too who felt that his training of them and his relations with them were very good and for them and for them at least, and they received an awful lot from Dr. Middleton, and I think they did.
Who were some of those people?
I think Ovid Meyer and Lemmer and all these people were great admirers of, and a lot of the alumni that weren't in the university are great admirers of Dr. Middleton,
mm-hmm.
but he became sort of a the thing to be.
Were these generally clinical people?
Yes.
Were there also?
And I wasn't a clinical man. I never had that experience with him, and so I was looking at it from a different, quite a different standpoint. I didn't.
Were there basic science people who were boosters of his?
Well, I don't think so as much. And especially by the time Bowers came here, there were a lot of people who thought it was time that they felt he was handling things somewhat arbitrarily lots of times. I think he did, probably. But that was the style of it. Mm-hmm. He'd inherited more or less in the school.
Who were some of the main critics in those later years?
Well, I think mainly the younger people. I wouldn't want to mention in particular, but there were a good many people who, younger people, who were talked about the old Middleton crowd, and who also talked about the Karari Mafia, unjustifiably, I think, especially in the case of Korea, of Karari. But that they were supporters of Bowers for a long time, especially when he first came.
Mm-hmm. What was?
I'd hate to make names. I think there supply names. I think there were many, mm-hmm. very many.
So my problem in researching this is to try to identify the arguments and how to find these people. And
well, I think the reason that people supported Bowers and his idea, or the general idea that they thought he had anyway, or reason he was brought here, was just the family idea that they were against this thing of people handing down their positions to their favorites, mm-hmm. and I think they thought Middleton was part of that group. There was a group of Middleton and Evans, Dr. Evans, and so on, who seemed to sort of run the university and or unit medical school, I mean, and who people thought just determined who became between a very small group.
It would be Washington. Middleton and Evans.
Middleton and Evans.
Pretty much just the
and
two of them.
Bardeen and Evans.
And Bardeen.
And in his day. Mm-hmm. And I think they felt that was the case, and this was becoming an inbred medical school. Mm-hmm. I think it was true.
Mm-hmm. When did this unhappiness with the situation start to develop, when we became?
Well, that's hard for me to say, but sure. But I would think that because I wasn't particularly unhappy with it. I didn't think much about it. I was busy on my own affairs. But I think it probably started in the latter days of Middleton's career, and particularly after the war and after money began to come in, and a lot of these young people for research, and a lot of these young people had gotten into departments and become assistant professors or associates in departments, a lot of these new people. And I think they were from outside, you see. I think they saw this inbreeding that mm-hmm. better than those of us who had been here all those years saw it.
Did they feel that they weren't receiving enough support for gaining new funding from the dean's office?
I don't think that was it. I think it was more resenting the idea that people were selected on by this family affair mm-hmm. deal.
Do you know why, or was there speculation as to why Middleton resigned?
No, I assume he just had enough of it. I don't know. I don't think he. Well, he was a clinician. He liked. I'm sure it's perfectly true as he, as one of these interviews indicated, that he wanted to be in the clinic. He wanted to be working with patients, and it got so Dean couldn't do that. There was too much else to do. and he didn't want that. And I would sympathize with him on that. I think it's perfectly logical.
Was there any kind of a...
I don't think there was any great any pressure from, certainly not from, not generally known anyway from anybody to get rid of Middleton. He was generally well-liked and respected highly.
When Bowers was selected, was there a discussion in the during the process of the selection among the faculty about possible alternative people?
Yes, there was. Some people wanted Mortensen, chairman, and, or dean, and mm-hmm. so on, but...
Who, why? What would his virtues have been?
Well, again, everybody knew him, liked him.
Mm-hmm.
People here, it was sort of a family affair. Mm-hmm. Mortensen was intelligent, very nice fellow. He was a Phi Beta Kappa when he was a student, one of the best anatomy students we had at the time, in anatomy, for instance, as I remember it. And a very personable individual and well-liked.
Would the Middleton supporters have supported him?
I think Middleton would have supported him.
Would the Middleton critics have supported him?
No. Mm. Mm. They wanted somebody new. They wanted to get new blood in him. Mm-hmm.
So yeah. The critics were at least initially pleased with Bowers' appointment.
Pretty what?
The critics were initially pleased with Bowers' appointment?
Yes, I think they were.
Mm-hmm. And what happened? How would you characterize Bowers' approach, his objectives for the medical?
Well, I think his the objectives he had as far in general were all right, but he just had a very abrasive approach to the thing, and was, well, I'd say no gentleman. I mean, he just antagonized people and by insulting them, practically.
What would be an example of something he'd do to put people off?
Well, I can't cite your personal... well, for one thing, people consider him a liar, and I think he was, a compulsive liar. Now, we were building the alumni had provided money for the medical library in honor of Dr. Middleton.
Yes.
And the librarian was, the lady who was librarian was an excellent librarian and had built the library up very well. And she was very anxious to have this library done right and did not approve the plans. So more than once, I think, she told me this herself, did not approve the plans that were ready when that Bowers thought were satisfactory.
Mm-hmm.
She said they were not satisfactory. He went out and told people that she was all for it, that this was these plans were right. Mm-hmm. And her interpretation of this is that he wanted to get the honor of having built the medical library while he was here. He was anxious to get that as one of his feathers in his cap, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And she says he deliberately lied about that to people time and again. And the head of physiology, Yeomans, told him he was a pathological liar. Called him that, and I think it was true. And he would do these things and still turn right around and ask the individual that he had insulted to do a favor for him. He had no sense of how people would feel about things he did to them.
So you think this was at the bottom of his developing problems here?
Oh yes, I'm sure it was. I'm sure if he'd been a personable, sensible person, used some judgment about how he treated people and when he and they looked ahead as a sequence of events as it would have happened, he could have, a dean at that time could have improved this medical school rapidly enough, mm-hmm. and quietly enough, so that within 10 years it would have been what he wanted.
What did he want?
Well, I think what he thought he wanted was a research-oriented clinical faculty. In fact, all the way through the school.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was the idea that he was going on and was brought here to carry out.
What would that mean? It's hard for an outsider to understand.
Well, I don't think it means, personally, I don't think it means an awful lot on the clinical side. Because unless you provide these clinicians with ample time and select the right ones, I don't see how they can do basic research to any extent. They can do clinical research. They can keep records of their patients and of what they see and so on and do research on the handling of certain conditions and all that.
So he was after getting clinical professors to do basic science research?
Well, I suppose to do real good basic research. Now, whether you call it basic science or not, for instance, people in the obstetrics department over the years have published a lot of papers on the human placenta, on the anatomy and histology and physiology of it. And a lot of those, as I told you a few minutes ago, I would just write off as worthless, mm-hmm. because they weren't controlled properly, they were done on too few specimens, they were done by people who didn't understand the basic development of fetal membranes and so on. Now, and the same thing is, to some extent, still true, that the physiology done by the physiology and pharmacology involvement done by these clinicians is not sound scientifically. In fact, it's getting so that almost anyone doing basic research should work with two or three For instance, people in anatomy should work with doing an anatomical research nowadays with the sophisticated equipment we have to use, should work with a physicist,
yes.
in many cases,
yes.
and or with a chemist.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody, an anatomist should work with a biochemist, certainly, many, many times on many things. He shouldn't try to do it all himself.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can't see how any physiological chemist, for instance, can know enough about the anatomical microscopic mm-hmm. situation in most organs to carry on sound research. He needs to, in many cases, not in all cases, of course, but in many cases, he needs to have cooperation with mm-hmm. an anatomist or histologist, at least,
mm-hmm.
or cell biologist, to interpret these things. And I think that's true, very true, of the clinical people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what I think Fred had in mind, and the people who, I don't know about Bowers, but I think Fred had in mind that these clinical people should work with the biochemistry department, the Ag School, and should mm-hmm. work with the physiological chemistry department mm-hmm. in the medical school and with the other in that sort of work, you see.
Did the clinical professors resist that? Did they conceive of that objective
I
the same
think
way?
Some of them, I don't think they resisted particularly, but I think that there were many of them who didn't want to do that sort of thing and weren't doing it and I suppose felt in danger
mm-hmm.
because of this. Danger of not being advanced or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, and maybe rightfully so in some cases.
Mm-hmm. Over the years, we talked earlier about the attitudes among the faculty members regarding women as faculty members or Jewish students.
Yes.
Did attitudes among the faculty change with regard to these groups of people as we
came
into
the... Oh, I think it's changed tremendously. I think you find very little anti-Semitism now.
Mm-hmm. Is there any time where a shift became apparent, or is it just something that happened slowly?
I don't know, but I'm impression that probably the war had a lot to do with it. Especially the German treatment of Jews.
Mm-hmm.
I think people realized that this was a dangerous situation to be in, and also I think such people as I can't think of names, the famous German who came over here, the physicist, the mathematician.
Einstein.
I think realization among the more literate people that there's a tremendous amount of very high talent in the Jewish population.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in the German Jewish and Polish Jewish populations. And I think that has had a lot to do with it.
Were there ever, to your knowledge, policies regarding the numbers of women that would be admitted to study graduate, MD programs?
Yes, I think there was a tendency to limit the number of women were taken one time, and I assume similar ideas to the number of Jewish people.
And that would have been the dean's policy?
That had been connected with the dean and the admissions committee.
Mm-hmm. Now,
They had an admissions committee way back, I think even, well, I don't know what they had in Bardeen's time, but I'm sure they must have had it in Middleton's time, an admissions committee, which would consist of Dean Meek and two or three others.
Would there be much discussion among the faculty of these policies? Or?
I don't think there's much discussion of it. I think the discussion about women's rights is a matter of the last 20, 25 years,
mm-hmm.
mainly.
Was there any with other minorities? Blacks? Was there a concern at that time? Were there enough blacks applying for medical school?
No, I don't think there was much concern about it. We had some very good blacks. I had one of the smartest men I ever had was a black who took his master's degree with me.
Mm-hmm. What year would that be, or what decade?
What year? I can put it here.
Nearly tell you here, I think.
He published a paper that he did in my lab. He published a paper in 1930.
So he wouldn't have had any trouble getting into the program. He wouldn't.
No, he was a straight A student, and very, very capable, and he was advised not to go here for his last 2 years, and I think rightly, by the dean. I think by Middleton, probably, by Bardeen probably. But he talked about this to me with me some. And it was felt that there would be lots of patients who wouldn't want him,
mm-hmm.
touching him, working with him,
mm-hmm.
and that he should go to Chicago, where there was a large Negro population,
mm-hmm.
for his clinical work, which he did, the University of Chicago, for his last 2 years, and he made their highest honors and everything there,
mm-hmm.
and apparently had no problems there. And he never had any problems here. We went up, he and I and other fellows in the department went out on hunting trips together and things like that. He was as black as anybody could be, but he was a very brilliant fellow.
Mm-hmm.
And well prepared. Morehouse College had been his college in Atlanta, and that was at that time and still is one of the best Negro colleges in the country, I guess. Mm-hmm. The best, perhaps. Must it be Howard?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the prejudice against Negroes and Jews is gradually dying out.
Mm-hmm. And in your view, do you think he was satisfied with the treatment he received?
Oh yes, I think he was. And he used to talk to me about practicing. He said, if I go into practice in Negro areas, there'll be a lot of them won't want me because I want a white doctor for mm-hmm. prestige.
Mm-hmm.
So he never went into practice in private practice. Well, he had private x-ray practice in Washington. I visited him there.
Did he?
Dinner, and one of the alumni was back. A fellow whom I never particularly liked, and I took Lala to the dinner. He was back here one time, long before he was sick.
Mm-hmm.
And at the Park Hotel, and one of these chaps, a former alumnus, or a former student of mine, stepped up to me and said, I don't like this black stuff. He was from Texas.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think much of this black stuff or something of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
And I've forgotten, I don't know what my remark to him was, but probably was that I didn't think too much of him either.
Mm-hmm. Would that have been in the 1950s?
That had been, way back probably in the 40s anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It might have been before the war. I'm not sure, it was one of the early alumni meetings. But there was that attitude. And of course, there was the same attitude about Jews, too.
Mm-hmm. When would you say that the shift occurred?
Well, I think the shift on both, as I said, came with the real shift countrywide, and here, too, came with the Second World War and realization of what Jews had been, what had been done with them, and the realization that it was absolutely unjustified, and also the fact that we'd had enough good students and seen enough of the brilliant people at the Jewish extraction
mm-hmm.
in the country to so that people in general realized the worth of the Jewish population.
Would you say that the earlier points of view regarding the Jews and the blacks and so on, and that was operating in Wisconsin, say during the 1930s. Was that a regional point of view? Was it, or did it represent more of a national way of viewing things?
I think more of a national thing, but I think that there was a regional element to it, because I think it was much worse, much more anti-Semitism in New York City and in New York in the eastern countries, eastern part of the country. I know when I was a graduate, when I was on leave at the Carnegie, there was a very nice young Jewish fellow who was taking a semester off to do some work there, and we had an Appalachian Club. It was a branch of it in Baltimore that I joined temporarily, and one of the very important members of it, influential members, was a technician, a woman, in the Carnegie Institution, one of the very good technician there, who went out on these trips with us. And one time they were talking about new people, I suggested we take this fellow along. Oh, no, Jewish, you wouldn't think of taking him. Think of taking him. Well, the interesting thing about it was that there was an Englishman friend of mine, Boyd, Dixon Boyd, whom later I was a co-author on the textbook that we wrote, was there with his wife. And they were very nice, very well-accepted people, and his wife was very doing research too, and she was a very nice person, a doctor. And I didn't know at the time, but she was a Jew, and she was well accepted by these mm-hmm. people, but they didn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
She was a graduate of, along with her husband, of the University of Belfast,
mm-hmm.
and they were married. And he was a professor at Cambridge, head of the anatomy department for a good many years at Cambridge. She was a clinician, did a lot of charity work in Cambridge, and so on. But
we can move now quickly to the larger picture of the university, to your relationships to the general university, to the medical school's relationships to the general university. You may have nothing to say on some of these questions, and that's just fine.
Right.
President Frank, how was he perceived by you and by the medical school?
Well, I perceived him as a misfit out here, brilliant fellow. But he would, I thought when he, I first saw him with his spats and the general attitude he had, that he would never get along here very well.
How did he strike you? What was it about his attitude that made you
feel
that way?
Well, he was a wonderful orator, and I think he was a better orator than he was thinker. And I've heard him give the same speech, excellent speech, and I've heard that the same speech was given to the Shoemakers Union and to the faculty of the university, and he could talk to anybody and make it sound good.
Was there a process?
When you got done, you wondered what he'd really said.
Uh-huh.
I wondered myself.
Was there discussion of this sort of thing early on? How did his status at the university change over the years? Was he immediately perceived in a certain way?
Well, by some of the more conservative people, and maybe I was among them, I don't know. I felt that he was a fellow that was just too much, as we'd say now, with it to, mm-hmm. for the area.
Mm-hmm. Were these mostly medical school people that you were thinking about?
No, just people in general.
Mm-hmm.
His wife was no great help to him. She was, she would call, there were lots of stories about her. She was, I suppose, a nice person, but she would call the building's grounds to come chase the squirrels off her roof so she could sleep in the daytime. Mm-hmm. Things like that. I mean, that was just things that weren't done here.
were there particular events that occurred during his presidency that highlighted his problems that you can recall?
I don't know. I suppose there were, but I wasn't close enough to it to
mm-hmm.
to know.
Were the medical school faculty people aware much of, say, the experimental college?
No, I don't think they were. Personally, I thought the experimental college was a very good thing,
mm-hmm.
and some of our best medics were graduates of that college.
That's all.
Some of our best men, John Parks, for instance,
mm-hmm.
and a very fine Jewish fellow, I can't think of his name now, that practiced in Illinois for a good many years, was a graduate of the college.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a real stimulus to people that were there.
Mm-hmm. President Dykstra.
Well, I never had much of anything to do with him. I always liked him. I think he was a He was a perfectly decent, intelligent person.
Did he have any influence, significant influence on the medical school to your...
I doubt it.
President Fred?
Well, I think he's the one that created all the disturbance, really, with Bowers.
How did...
It wasn't his fault, uh-huh. necessarily. It was Bowers' fault.
What did he do to cause this?
Well, I think bringing Bowers here, I don't think Fred did anything himself, but mm-hmm. bringing Bowers here was just a bad choice. He didn't pay enough attention to Bowers' personality, I think. Mm-hmm. Maybe he didn't know it. I probably didn't know it.
Was there any discussion by the time he brought Bowers that... Fred tended to consult with a lot of people before he'd do anything.
Yes, I've heard that.
Did he consult among medical school faculty members?
I suppose he did, probably. Apparently, from what Phil writes, I think he consulted with him, didn't he?
Yes, he says he did.
And I suppose he did. I never heard anything about it.
Mm-hmm. President Alvium.
Well, I think he was much in favor of the research type faculty in the medical school, but I don't know how much he really contributed to advancing it.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, Harrington.
It had so little to do with these people, you see. Mm-hmm. My impression of Harrington was that he was a good man mm-hmm. for the job. One thing he did, I think he did, that I did have a little something to do with, there was an art exhibit. The art departments had an exhibit at the Union. At the same time, one year, at the same time, the legislature was meeting and deciding on the university budget, 2-year budget. And the art department put up an exhibit down there that was really pornographic, sadly pornographic, largely pornographic. Things that weren't, to my mind, art at all, fire hydrants painted with a top like the gland's penis,
mm-hmm.
and so on, all that sort of thing. And I went down there, I happened to go down to be in the Union, I went in to see this exhibit. And there was so much of this stuff, I thought, my gosh, if these legislators come down here and if some of these people get this news out to back in their home bailiwicks, this sort of thing going on and the money being spent for this sort of thing in the university, that's going to have a bad effect in the university. So I wrote a letter immediately to Harrington and told him this exhibit was to be up for a month or something like that. Mm-hmm. It was down within 2 days. The time I wrote the letter, he never said anything to me about it.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that more than one person contacted him on that. Mm-hmm. Certainly was a reasonable thing to do. And anyway, I think he saw the danger of that sort of thing. It was just not art. It was purely...
Was there any controversy following this?
Hmm?
Do you know of any controversy?
I don't know any. There might have been in the art department, or with the art department. I have no idea.
Didn't come out in the newspapers anyway, to your knowledge?
No, I don't think it did. I think it was taken down. I think it happened to be, I don't think it's up more than a week.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's taken down soon now so that it didn't get into the papers.
Some people like Mark Ingram have been very concerned about the governance of the university and the faculty's part in that. And from what I can tell from my own studies, a bird hit the window.
I think so.
He's all right, he flew off.
He flew off, didn't he? Sometimes I drop down and...
How would you characterize the participation of medical school faculty in different types of participation of governance in the university as a whole.
Well, I don't believe the clinical people have much to do with it. There may be some that do, I don't know, but I don't think they're interested, mm-hmm. particularly. But I think the preclinical people, like the rest of the, like the LNESCO and so on, do have a interest in it and do take part in it.
Say during the 1930s, where there would be a general faculty meeting, yeah. would the preclinical people have attended those meetings? Did you?
Yes, they would have. They would have. We didn't attend faculty meeting always, but mm-hmm. some people were much more regular in that than others.
Mm-hmm. Were there people who tended to join all university committees? The university committee, for instance. Was that an important committee for medical school faculty?
I don't know. I don't know. I think there were some probably that did. I don't know.
So. You had said that you'd been a member of the divisional biological division committee,
yes.
Which strikes me as closely associated with your own work as a
yeah.
scholar.
Yeah.
Were there other kinds of committee assignments that you had that were farther away from your science?
No, I don't. I served on committees in the medical school, of course, library committee and that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
and the university library committee.
Mm-hmm. When did you do the university library committee?
Oh, gee, I don't remember. It's way back. It's when...
Would that have been before Memorial Library was built?
Yes. While it was still in the... Well, the university was still in the historical building.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What were some of the concerns that you dealt with on that committee?
Oh, it's been a long time ago.
Sure.
I suppose mainly acquisitions, money for acquisitions, and what type of acquisitions to get.
Mm-hmm.
And also, to some extent, trying to persuade faculty members to request.
Mm-hmm.
Books. There was no one. That's one thing that Miss Crawford has done for the medical library. She has definitely tried to find out what books faculty members wanted and
mm-hmm.
should have.
Mm-hmm.
Kept track of that sort of thing. And of course, that's a big problem in the university library. What books should you really choose out of the millions that are published.
Yes.
If you really want to know something about that, talk to Naseth, Professor retired now,
mm-hmm.
who was assistant librarian for many years, and who I know well, and I think admire
fine
as a good man. You know him? You know him?
No, I don't.
Know of him?
No. Yes, I've heard his name.
Naseth. Naseth. Naeseth. Naseth.
Fine.
Yeah. He could give you a lot of information on that sort of thing. He was assistant librarian for a long time.
What types of activities were there, say during the 1930s again, that would help you meet other faculty members?
Well, besides these biological division, I think mainly the, I suppose the university club, of course, would, but to meet people in my field, Sigma Xi Society, mm-hmm. you know of it?
Yes.
Sigma Xi. And then there were two biological societies,
mm-hmm.
Phi Sigma Biological Society, we met once a month,
mm-hmm.
but that was mainly for graduate students. But Sigma Xi was for faculty
mm-hmm.
and people who already graduated. And then there was Alpha Gamma Rho, I think it was called, another general scientific fraternity, mm-hmm. who held meetings. And Sigma Psi was important because it was primarily for the older, for the people already on the faculty, mm-hmm. and we had meetings, practically every meeting, well, most meetings were lectures. Somebody invited in to give a lecture. It was one of the Sigma Psi Society dues provided honoraria for outside speakers from mm-hmm. Chicago or some place like that, and for a good many years until the other till grants and so on, and the WRF took over. Now for those early years, Sigma Psi was quite important. It got to the point where Sigma Psi is now just kind of a, I suppose they meet once a year, and mm-hmm. that's about all.
Fred Harvey Harrington discusses the work of, or the efforts of social science and humanities scholars to gain greater support for their research. And he seems to indicate that there was growing concern among the social scientists and humanities late in the Depression years, late 1930s, for instance, to gain access or greater support from Wharf. What do you recall that there was this public discussion of this kind of concern?
I don't know of any public discussions of it.
Were there discussions among faculty members privately that you know of?
Well, I'm sure there were, but I wasn't a party to mm-hmm. any of it that I remember.
Did you think much or have much knowledge about the way that Wharf money was dispersed to the faculty?
You didn't have much knowledge of it, no. I never knew.
Were you concerned during the post-war years and the 1950s regarding how that money should be distributed? Did it concern you that it should or shouldn't go to social science people?
No, it didn't. I would think it should, as well as to the others, if they had projects that were good. Mm-hmm. Actually, of course, it was based on science, not social science.
Yes.
It was result of scientific work, and I think that's why a lot of people felt it. Actually, why shouldn't we have the full benefit of it? Mm-hmm. And I think I would go along with that in a general way, although I don't see why they should not occasionally support things that are in the social sciences.
Mm-hmm. Were there, this is a very nebulous question, but it's one that we have to try to get at. Did scientists yourself, for instance, have any kind of an opinion about the quality of research produced by social scientists?
Yes, I think we did, and without knowing very much about it, certainly in my case, not really knowing, but I suppose even yet I would have the idea that a lot of so-called social science isn't science. Part of the evidence being that you get absolutely contrary conclusions from same source of material mm-hmm. in so many cases. And while that's occasionally true in real science, it shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a little prejudiced against it. Mm-hmm. Calling it, I think probably the fact they call it science. Now, of course, when you come right down to it, all sorts of problems can be attacked in a scientific way, which just means gathering evidence, and the best evidence you can get, and then formulating some type of hypothesis or theory to go on to ask more questions and try to verify it.
Was there discussion among your colleagues about just what you're talking about now?
I think there was some, but not, in my case, not any of it had any particular influence on mm-hmm. such things.
Again, with reference to the 1930s, did you have any how did you conceive of yourself as a university citizen? What part did you see yourself playing in the larger picture at the university?
Well, I didn't see myself playing much part in the larger. I simply felt that my job was to do my work and that I've been hired to do, and to spend my time at it, not be a farmer or a landlord or something of that sort. That after all, this is what I asked people to hire me to do, and I liked it, and why not spend my time at it? That's what I'm doing now.
You mentioned at the beginning of our interview that you decided when you were about 10 that you wanted to do this. Sounds like it worked.
Yes. I do feel that people who I know several faculty members, even the medical school, basic sciences, for instance, who have a farm up in the central part of the county or somewhere. Their family stays on the farm. Their wife never comes into meetings, to social gatherings. They run back and forth every day, spend 2 or 3 hours back and forth, and spend the summers working on the farm. I don't think that's right. I mean, it's legal, but I don't think it's the thing that a faculty member should do. I think he should be here in the city somewhere or near it where he can take part in things, and that should be his major interest. If he wants to own a farm and occasionally go out for a vacation and have somebody running it, that's a different matter. But to spend his time doing it himself, I think is wrong. I have a cousin down here in Whitewater who's doing that, has his farm, and he's a geologist. He should be spending his time in geological work, not on that farm.
Now, this point of view you express, has that been shared by your colleagues, and has that point of view changed over time at the university?
I don't know about that at all. I've never discussed this with people very much. I've seen people that obviously had my attitude toward it, and I've seen people who obviously had the other attitude, but as far as discussing it.
From your observation, would you say that your point of view described the faculty in general at any time?
I think prevailed. I think yes, I think so.
At when?
Well, I think all the time. I think the better faculty, the faculty that have stayed on and that run the university, are people who spend their time on university things. Mm-hmm.
Would you include in that group the people who you've described earlier as the people who were at the university club and were interested in becoming administrators and leaders? And
yes, yes. I think those people spend their time. Most of them spend their time in university matters. Mm-hmm.
So it wouldn't necessarily be people who were dominated by their field of study?
No, I don't think so. I think there are people who just as sincere about being good administrators as anything else.
Yes.
Any rest of us.
Just to conclude now, I was wondering if you'd like to comment either on prominent university-wide personalities, and if you'd like
university
university personalities.
Yes.
If there are any people who you think were especially distinguished in some way that we should be studying about.
Well, I think most of them that I would know you would already have.
Well,
Jim Crow comes to mind. Of course, there are people like McShann, who died recently, who most of us didn't realize were quite as informed and interested in things as they were. Mm-hmm. I knew him well, but didn't realize that he was.
And who was that?
McShann. You know, he was a he was R.K. Meyer's right-hand man, something like Judea was Burgess' right-hand man.
Mm-hmm.
And he was overshadowed by Meyer, but actually he was quite a fellow himself. And I don't think most people realize that.
What would you say characterized him?
Well, he was very faithful, very careful, honest fellow, and modest, didn't push himself at all, and turned out that he was he contributed a great deal to the line of work that Meyer was in.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody realized it, and he also was a man who was interested in. He was a. I was quite surprised to learn that he was quite a liberal in his political things, and had done a lot for. With various organizations like Planned Parenthood and things of that sort that I didn't realize he was involved with.
Mm-hmm.
But I offhand, I can't think of people that should be interviewed, that certainly have interviewed or will. I can't think of other people quite so like he was. I suppose there are people who are not very known, very well known, who really have a lot of insight into some of these things.
Yes. Well, let me name some people, and if you care to comment, you could. Letters and Science Dean Celery.
You mean he's not living now?
No. But he was obviously a key personality for Letters and Science.
Yes. Well, I didn't know. That was when I was too young to really know very much about him.
Mm-hmm.
So my comment wouldn't mean much.
Dean Ingram, Letters and
Science. I knew him. He was an excellent man, of course. And I never knew very much about his policies and so on, but.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very fine person and very intelligent, I thought.
Was he well known among the medical school faculty? Would you
guess? I think so. He was a great promoter of the humanities,
mm-hmm.
in addition to his math. And perhaps some of the scientific people, I suspect, would maybe think he was too much. So compared to
mm-hmm.
the science that he, but I don't think he was. He was a well-rounded person in every way, and he'd had a fine family background. He'd had all the advantages of growing up in a family that was prominent,
mm-hmm.
apparently. He and his wife and mine were very good friends, and I got to know him that way.
Charles Slichter, when you were here, he was the graduate dean.
He was dean of the graduate school. Well, it was said, and I guess it was true, that if you wanted anything, if you wanted a promise, he'd promise you anything, but you better get it in writing.
Mm-hmm.
And that was true.
Do you have any
people
examples?
Actually asked him to put it in writing.
Mm-hmm. How was he?
He would just change his mind, and you'd think you had something going, and find out you didn't.
Mm-hmm. Ira Baldwin.
Well, he's the next door neighbor across here. I better be careful.
Okay.
Oh, he's an old friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
We had a run in or two, but. I think he's been a very, very important person in the campus here for many years.
What would you say his primary contributions would have been?
Oh, coordinator of all sorts of agricultural activities. And worldwide, he's traveled and spent a lot of time in Indonesia and so on.
Mm-hmm. Max Auto.
I was a great admirer of Max Auto myself. My wife came here, a Methodist, very trained, or brought up in a rather strict Methodist family, and so on. Took his course.
When would this have been?
1922 or 3.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know just when she took his course, but she didn't agree with him on a lot of things, but she admired his philosophies. He started in telling them he'd probably break their faith before the semester was over. And I don't think he broke her faith in it by any means, but I think in a way, but I think he made her sensible about all these things, religious affairs.
Mm-hmm.
I've known, my next door neighbor here, Mrs. Rice, who was Mrs. Briggs for many years, married the Rice of the law school after mm-hmm. his wife died.
Mm-hmm.
She's a great liberal and worked with, was secretary to, I can't think of that name either. She and Otto were very good friends.
The lady next door?
Next door here, yes. And they thought the same way. She's probably a little more radical than he was,
mm-hmm.
religious way. But he was reasonable. I mean, he asked people to take the evidence and to think things through. Not just take somebody's word for everything.
How was he regarded among the family?
Bible. Well, he's regarded as a devil by some people, of course, but most people regard him highly, I think.
Do you think that he had any influence on the public's view of the university?
I suppose he did. I suppose some people criticized him very highly and got. I suppose it went down to people who were conservative religious people.
Mm-hmm. So his...
And they would not like it, of course.
His...
But if you knew the man, I didn't know him that well, but uh-huh. I think if you'd known the man, you would have thought quite differently about some of the things that may have been said about him.
Mm-hmm. In what connection did you know him? How would you run into Max Auto?
I didn't know him really personally. He probably didn't know me,
mm-hmm.
but I knew from people who did know him and from hearing him talk and from my wife's taking his course and so on,
mm-hmm.
the way I knew him.
So you have heard him speak?
Yes.
Where would he have been speaking that you would have heard him?
Well, I think he gave lectures occasionally, public lectures.
Mm-hmm. And that would have been on religious matters?
Well, it would have been on philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't recall the moment of ever hearing him any specific time, but I'm sure I did.
Yes.
And I've read some of the things he's written, things like that.
Tom Brittingham.
Quite an influence on the distribution of money while he was here, and I think he was always interested in the cutting edge, so to speak, as they call it now, of research,
mm-hmm.
and was not very sympathetic to people who were not on that edge, including myself.
Mm.
I asked him once for some money. He wasn't interested
mm-hmm.
in what I had to do. He said he wasn't interested in that type of thing. But I think he was perfectly honest about it, and right in a way.
Were there other people in his category, people who weren't faculty members, but who in one way or another were real supporters of the university? that come to mind?
I suppose they were, but I don't know them.
Mm-hmm. Would you say he was the most prominent one in the 30s?
Well, he's the one that I've heard of most, of course, yeah. Because they had a lot of money and they were a well-known family here.
Mm-hmm. Were you aware?
He's supposed to have made his money, you know, investing in, as I understand it, investing in new young companies,
mm-hmm.
that were promising. He had apparently had either advisor or he himself had good sense in picking the right company to invest in.
Mm-hmm. Are there other people that come to mind that would have fit on my list if I would have made a better list?
Well, I don't know. It's hard for me to think of people out of
sure.
thin air.
Can you think of medical school people who our history would benefit from if I would interview them?
Well, the older people are, most of them are gone now, but I tell you, a person who knows a lot about it, I don't always, he may have been interviewed, probably has, that's the doctor, names are your name, some of them. My own sometimes, I guess, doesn't come to me. Dr. Mortensen claimed I introduced him as Dr. Mossman once. He's living over in Winter Park. He was in the clinical department for years, gastroenterologist. Better talk about something else. Let me jot it down.
I think we've covered the main topics that I
he's a man that should, he had a lot to do with the getting the new medical school buildings and so mm-hmm. on. He knew the legislature.
Fine, we'll want to try to identify.
Know him well, he belongs to the West End Club, he belongs to the Card and Camera Club that I belong to, Sladen. Slide Movie Club, I guess they call it.
Well, I'll send you a note this afternoon asking you to
I'll get his name.
As well as the, we agreed yesterday about the records, if we could find them for the West End Club.
Yeah.
Do you have a closing comment that you'd like to make, statement?
Well, I guess the main thing I'm hoping is that this is of some use and that it will be properly edited.
It will.
Okay.